Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The war continues. Tehran says no surrender to the U.S. and that diplomacy is wiser than war. At the same time, Trump threatens to renew hostilities. It is difficult to say whether any real diplomacy is in play. Meanwhile, the global economy is being hammered. Crosstalking the search for peace, I'm joined by my guest, Joshua Landis in Oklahoma City. He is the director of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. In South Carolina, we have Ethan Livens. He is an independent social media journalist. And in Islamabad, we cross to Hanan Hussein. He is a senior expert at Initiate Futures. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Joshua, let me start out with you in Oklahoma City. As I said in my introduction, Trump still threatens to reinitiate hostilities, and Iran has made it very, very clear it's not going to surrender, which leaves me to the conclusion here on day 83 is there's not going to be any kind of conventional end to this conflict. Your thoughts?
Yes. Well, President Trump seems to be promising different things to different people. On the one hand, he told Netanyahu, evidently, that that there would be an article in whatever agreement there was that all the nuclear material would be taken out of Iran with an agreement. Now, at the same time, he has told journalists twice that nobody can get the nuclear material out from underneath the mountain in which it was destroyed, under which it is destroyed, and that that Iran can effectively not make a nuclear bomb, but that's not good enough for social media. So Iran has said that they will not export their uranium, and that's really the rub here. President Trump has promised, seems to be trying to work on two different levels. One is to make an agreement with Iran in which Iran would, there would be some guarantees that Iran would never make a nuclear bomb. At the same time, he can't get Iran to export all the uranium, and yet the Israelis are demanding that. So he's stuck in the middle, and we're really stuck at this point here, threatening to increase the war, finish the job, as he says, which I guess is regime change, and he can't do that. So he's really on a bind here, as is the world economy.
Yeah, the world economy. It's really interesting, all the economies around the world that have nothing to do with this conflict, and they're being hammered. And given estimates, it's only going to get worse, even if this crisis were resolved today. Ethan, let me go to you. You know, Trump is demanding that Iran give up all of its leverage, okay? And, you know, as much as meaning Trump and his acolytes talk about the nuclear file, that's really one of the easiest things to resolve. We had that before the conflict started with the Omani initiative here. But at the end of the day, the Iranians want to know that this isn't going to happen to them again in 6 months, 9 months, a year. There's nothing that Donald Trump can say, not even to mention the Israelis, to give that guarantee. That's why I posited to Joshua is that in a conventional sense, we're never going to see an end to this conflict. We'll see maybe it simmer down, but it's going to stay this way for a long time. And as Joshua ended his first answer, the global economy is tanking. Go ahead, Ethan.
Yeah, neither side wants to give in. It's pretty obvious. Trump doesn't want to give in. He's the art of the deal guy. He refuses to give in. And why should the Iranians give in? They hold all of the leverage. They have the Strait of Hormuz, the uranium's in Iran. What possibly could they give up? Because they've given up the uranium before, and look where we're at now. They're in a war. They got attacked in June. They're getting attacked now. So what possibly could the United States give the Iranians besides maybe a sanction relief package, which yet again, we had some form of that back in the JCPOA, and that was ripped up by Trump. So how can the Iranians believe that if they make another deal with the United States, that Trump isn't just going to rip it up again? Because in my opinion, the ultimate outcome of this for the Israelis is regime change. They don't care about the uranium. They've never cared about the uranium. It's always been about regime change. For the past few decades, they've used the United States to do that. And this is another tool of that. No matter how much the U.S. is harmed and the world is harmed with the Strait of Hormuz closure, they don't care because it doesn't harm them. And the Iranians hold all of the leverage. They hold all of the cards, essentially. And if you're the Iranians, why should you give this up? Because you essentially came out of this war with more leverage than you had before. So if the Americans want to launch another war against you, from their perspective, they say bring it on. Maybe they come out of this even better yet again, and Trump has to do something to get out of this, to get some sort of victory for himself, and he's going to refuse to give in. He's going to refuse to surrender, and that's why we could go down a path of war, because the United States is going to have to do that in order to shuffle up the cards and shuffle up the leverage.
Yeah, I mean, or maybe he can do what the Romans used to do, just declare victory and go home, okay, irrespective of what the situation on the ground is. Anand, let me go to you in Islamabad. Pakistan has played a very important role in negotiations and whatever diplomacy is being deployed. And I'm not asking you to speak on behalf of your government there, but, you know, I hear about the 14-point plan, 10-point plan, and it doesn't seem to ever go anywhere. Do you believe that there's any real diplomacy going on? Because, gentlemen, the last two times diplomacy was employed, the U.S. and Israel were preparing for an attack. So I think the past is a guide forward here. Anand in Islamabad, what do you think?
I think on the broader point, you make a clear case. So, for example, that has been the case. Evidence points to that as well. When diplomacy has been going forward, the Iranians were constantly given the signal that, you know, they could basically be on the lookout for some sort of trust surplus with the U.S. The mediation could take a curve, which would be different from past terms, but we haven't seen that. In fact, what we have seen is this emerging pattern of U.S. strikes as they try to take diplomacy in tandem. So that's where things are right now. But I think Pakistan's role as of now is a bit more nuanced. So, for example, when you've seen senior officials go over there, it hasn't basically been just a wizard which has just been called because Pakistan feels so. There's a greater need, for example, for Iran to be informed about the U.S. proposal. So, for example, Trump's adventurism has led to a rupture in terms of strategic communication, something which, regardless of hostilities, has to sustain, because this war, partly driven by U.S. actions, has contributed to a global catastrophe, be it on the economic front, on the energy front as well. So a lot of countries, regardless of the U.S. and Iranians talking, want the strategic communication to go forward. I think Pakistan turns out to be that key lever, because if you leave Pakistan out for a moment, a lot of the stuff is happening behind closed doors, because Trump's own megaphone diplomacy tends to take an outside role in how things are happening. I think those optics are something which the Iranians and regional security at large is sensitive to. So to answer your question, I think Pakistan's, I'd say, sticking its neck out for both Iran and the U.S. to maintain communication, have a soft agreement hammered out, is something which is a confidence-building measure. Will the U.S. kind of subscribe to that? From where things stand, I think they tend to do more self-inflicted damage.
Just that recently the United States just isn't really interested in diplomacy. It doesn't even have the capacity. I mean, the number of experts that have been fired from the State Department and the intelligence community because they disagree with the policy. Joshua, it's something that I've been keeping a close eye on is that looking at the kind of public and private diplomacy that Iran is conducting, they are talking to the monarchies in the Gulf. And I think that they would like to cut the U.S. out of this and deal directly with Gulf security. And, you know, if there's security for all, there can be prosperity for all, meaning this 47-year blockade and blocking Iran has to come to an end. The region has to figure out its own problems, then it can go broader. That's my working theory. Joshua.
Well, in theory, you're right. The trouble is the GCC, the Gulf countries,
they're divided.
Exactly. The UAE has really thrown its cards with Israel and the United States. And as we saw, it got the Iron Dome and Netanyahu has visited them. Saudi Arabia wants stability and has decided to try to negotiate with Iran and call a truce for this, and has asked the United States not to escalate, not to bomb, because it's frightened that this will only deteriorate the economy in the region. So the GCC is at cross purposes, and that really leaves United States and Israel, Iran in the driver's seat here. But meantime, the economies are really where the story is. Yeah. And this game of chicken. The newspapers in the United States this morning are full of stories about the Iranian economy, which many hope, of course, in the administration is going to crash, because well over a million jobs have been lost. Evidently, about 12 million jobs in Iran are dependent on IT and the internet and online jobs, and the internet has not been working for several months now in Iran. So this is taking a terrible toll on the Iranian economy, but at the same time, it's taking a terrible toll on the international economy. And interest rates have gone up in the United States significantly. The price at the gas tank is costing Americans billions. It's costing the whole world billions. And third world countries like Egypt, many in Africa, are teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. So this the entire international community is on the phone to President Trump saying, you need to dial this down and find a diplomatic solution. So at the same time, this ultimately is a big game of chicken on the economic level right now. And President Trump thinks he can ride it out. And he just had a very good story for himself in elections in Kentucky, where a congressman who had bucked Trump's war and his pro-Israeli policies was completely destroyed in primary elections. So that was good news for Trump, who thinks that he can sail into these midterm elections.
I think Trump is dangerously wrong. I think with the whole Massey election, he destroyed MAGA completely. It's no longer a political force. It's a cult now. But I think that we'll be able to read that in a very different way as we approach the midterms. But you're absolutely right. He can keep the rank and file in order, but the economy is not going to get any better. He can't wish it demanded to get better, considering the circumstances.
Gentlemen, and young people are defecting in droves.
Exactly. Or they won't vote at all. They won't vote at all. Why? Why would they vote in a system that is rigged like this? Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the topic of, is there a search for peace? Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the search for peace. Okay, let's go back to Ethan. At the very end of the first part of the program, Joshua invoked the phrase "a game of chicken." Let's continue with that. If you're looking at the players in playing this very dangerous game, where are you going to put your money? You're going to put it on Trump? You're going to put it on Israel? Or are you going to put it on Iran?
Well, with the way things are moving, I'm putting it on Iran, and that is interesting to say because I'm an American and I just want this to be completely over. And if we can have an Iranian quasi-victory to where we get some sort of deal, it's over, and my gas prices can go down because this sucks right now. So the Israelis don't want this to be over. The Israelis want this to go on forever. The Israelis want this game of chicken to go on indefinitely because for them, they're not suffering anything. It's American jets, it's American planes, American helicopters, American soldiers, it's everything. The Strait of Hormuz is our problem. Apparently, it's NATO's problem, as Trump likes to call it. But he says it will never be Israel's problem. He said the other day that he's 99% in Israel. He could run for prime minister in Israel. This guy is obsessed with Israel, and it's like he's defending Israel from every blowback of this war right now. And he doesn't care because our economy right now, I'm a young guy in the U.S. This is not very good. I got to go to the grocery store later. I'm not excited. But for the Israelis, this is a home run for them. This is amazing for them.
Well, they get America to fight
their biggest enemy.
Ethan, you started out by saying, you know, you're an American. Okay. But you really, you know, if there's going to be a quasi-victory for Iran, you don't care. Would you say that that's very commonplace, particularly of your generation? I mean, you know, what is it in for you? What do you get out of this? You get nothing out of this. And it's something that, you know, I've been saying for most of my adult life that, you know, the average people don't get anything out of empire. But now that seems to be common currency with your generation. Is that correct?
Oh, 100%. Me and my friends, we talk about it every day. I actually had a conversation with one of them yesterday. He said, dude, gas prices are almost at $5. When's this going to be over? I said, I don't know. Call up Trump, because he obviously really doesn't care right now. Hormuz is still shut. And instead of trying to get that open, they're about to relaunch another war, which would just drive everything even higher. Everything would get more expensive. And I really wish he did care. I really wish that the U.S. and Trump and the government did care about grocery prices, gas prices, and the normal standard of living. But instead, they're going and flocking off on a war for the Israelis because the Iranians don't have an ICBM. They cannot launch a missile at the United States. They're not a threat to me or to my family or any of my friends, even in Europe. They're not a threat to them. It's pretty obvious. But for the Israelis, they feel threatened. So we have to go clean up their mess. And a lot of people my age, especially my age and the younger crowd, are very upset at this because we're starting to really understand that this is all for a separate country and that our own country, sadly and very annoyingly, does not care about us.
Let's go back to Islamabad. Hanan, how is this going to change? How is this changing the security dynamics of the region? Because for 47 years, Iran has been denied its rightful role. Do you see that one of the outcomes of this is that the region working more closely together? Of course, I can understand the Gulf monarchies not being very happy with their infrastructure being destroyed, but there were American bases there. How is this going to change? Because there seems to be, for lack of a better term, a stalemate here. Do you think it's going to be other actors that are going to have to take the reins and start moving this forward? Because Iran is not going to surrender. It's been in a cage for 47 years. It's not going to go back in it.
I think on three levels, you're going to see some changes happening. And I think largely the change is going to be in terms of strategic thinking. So, for example, the Gulf states, their sense of autonomy, their rising discontent with unmet U.S. promises, something which is going to come out a bit more closely. We do see that in diversifying security partnerships. We also see that in terms of quiet economic partnerships, which go beyond the U.S. and elsewhere. But I think at the same time, it's important to note that as unpopular as Trump's tactics may be, it's also the fact that the U.S., as a strategic partner for many of these countries, still lands in those books. I think the vulnerability over there is that the U.S. cannot credibly hold on to commitments which, let's say, about three, four decades ago would have been in some ways ironclad. So that's on the U.S. the Gulf front. On the Iranian front, I think, you talked about, for example, them not being, given their rightful due. I think that's true. We've seen that in Iran's compliance with the JCPOA as well. We've also seen that with Iran's repeated recourse to dialogue, because it's important to note to your viewers as well, this is a war which the U.S. started. So when you're on the receiving end, thousands of casualties, blockades and all of that, and then this economic coercion narrative going around, then of course Iran in some ways has to defend itself. But I think over there, the change that I see is that Iran's definition of self-defense is something which could run into a little bit of a collision course with Gulf powers beyond this war, because where things stand, it's a bit unsustainable. So either way, I think the biggest change is going to be the deterioration in the U.S. credibility to offer assurances and Gulf and Iranian partners to kind of look beyond the U.S. for additional security guarantee, be it energy, economic, or political.
Yeah, because what's happening right now is not working. We all have to remember that, during the oil crises of the 1970s, it wasn't a production. It was, it was a boycott. Now we have infrastructure in that region that has been destroyed. That's very different than what happened in the 1970s. Joshua, it seems to me, if the past informs us, as Trump is going to strike again. For what reason? Unclear. For what objective? Just the spite punishment to control the news cycle. It doesn't seem that, he's not achieved any of his goals, and those goals have changed, I know, over time. I mean, it's just a complete fiasco, but it will finish with another round of hostilities. Joshua.
Well, it's very possible that he will bomb more, but Iran is threatening, of course, to go up the escalation ladder if it does. And it's said now that not only will it attack the Gulf states and their electric plants, their water, salination, and so forth, but it might take it into the Red Sea and close shipping through the Red Sea with the Houthis and so forth. Now, it's not clear that Iran can do that, but the notion of escalation has the entire world very worried about this, because right now oil supplies and oil reserves in most countries have either run out or on the verge of running out. And so if this war drags on for a lot longer, the costs are going to escalate tremendously. And so far, the economy, for example, in the United States, has a very contradictory story, because on the one hand, prices are shooting up, which are just hammering the lower 50% of Americans. But at the same time, AI and the stock market are at almost all-time highs in the United States. So the top 50% that have some money in the stock market are not feeling so much pain. And this is driving a wedge between Americans, the lower 50% who are getting increasingly poorer and poorer, and the upper 50% who are keeping up with inflation and who are making money. And in the White House, of course, people are making money hand over fist.
You bet they are.
So it's a very contradictory story, and it's unclear how that's going to play out politically. But of course, for much of the world, this is not, there isn't that stock market bump. And the price is very high because oil, because they're living so close to the margin of poverty and imports.
Ethan, how's your stock portfolio? I mean, you and all of your friends are in the market, right? I mean, are you diversifying into gold yet? You don't have to tell me your personal finances here, but, I look at you and I'm sure you play the market every day.
Yeah, every day I wake up and I trade, I day trade and all of that, big time money into the defense contractors. Yes, that's what I'm worried about at my age. It's totally not gas and milk and like what I'm going to eat for lunch. I have no idea. But yeah, stocks are definitely not what I'm worried about. Maybe my dad, but still, yet again, not like the bottom half of the United States. We're not that too worried about what Boeing and Lockheed Martin are doing. And it, I say it again, but it really does suck because, yeah, the people in the White House are making a lot of money. The top 10, top 50% are making a lot of money. So the people that are making these decisions, they're not feeling what's actually happening. They're fully disconnected to the reality of Americans right now, that we are suffering and having to pay higher prices with inflation. It is just a disconnect from the upper half of society, which is the government, the people in the Congress, and of course, the White House, Trump and all of his friends, all of his family. I mean, these people are multi-billionaires. Great, good for them. But I just wish they cared about me and my family and all 300 million plus Americans and what we're having to deal with because of the war that they wanted to start. And this is just the reality that they're not going to ever fully understand what we're going to have to go through, what we're going to have to pay. The real ones paying the price for this war are your average Americans, your above, below average Americans, like me, like my family, like my friends.
Yeah, but Donald Trump already made it clear he doesn't care. He made it very explicit that he doesn't care. Anand, let me go to you in Islamabad here. How does this move forward? I mean, the region, we look at these Gulf countries. I mean, I've always kind of thought of them as kind of brands and stuff like that. But they can't survive much longer. The implications are immense for the global economy, not just for the region.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as dim as the prospects seem, there are silver linings on taking this thing forward. So, for example, as Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and key Gulf partners are witnessing huge costs coming from a war they did not start, then obviously the U.S. has limited leverage compared to what President Trump announces publicly. So, for example, when it comes to staying off attacks or dialing up military escalation, U.S. risks straining its alliances even further. That's the cost which the U.S. in the long run simply cannot afford, because your entire Middle Eastern calculus turns out to be shaping to U.S.'s detriment. So that's the U.S. constraint over there. And I think moving forward, we do see that in diplomacy as well. As I told you, much of the action is happening behind closed doors. So Pakistan at present, when it's seeing a leadership due in Tehran reportedly this week, will be communicating certain softer goals on which there is a softer consensus. So President Trump would not want to concede to that publicly because he's a bit sensitive about his public image and wants to portray a narrative of victory. But the fact is that the U.S., after months of war, a key fixture in that has been to move towards diplomacy, which gives the U.S. a less shambolic exit, which is acceptable. Yeah. So I think you'd see them coming out a bit.
Yeah, I think we all agree. They just need some kind of punchline to get out of this and just, accept, take the L, as they say, and move on. Gentlemen, fascinating discussion. I wish we had more time. I want to thank my guests in South Carolina, Oklahoma, and in Islamabad. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.